This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 15, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, U.S. senators debate a measure that would deny medical coverage for employees due to religious or moral beliefs. Advocates say it could signal an expanding attack on reproductive rights. Chicago residents protest a charter school discipline policy that fined students in low-income neighborhoods. And the federal and state mortgage deal with five of the country's biggest banks is supposed to offer relief for struggling homeowners, but in Wisconsin, the governor has other plans for the funds. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Honduras, a prison fire late Tuesday night claimed the lives of nearly 350 inmates who were trapped in their cells. After the fire, relatives of the prisoners, desperate for news, reportedly tried to force their way into the prison. They were stopped by police with tear gas. The death toll makes this one of Latin America's worst prison fires in recorded history. FSRN's Tim Russo brings us more from Honduras.
Officials say that the causes of Tuesday's Comayagua prison fire are still unknown, but may be attributed to a short circuit in the electrical system. The prison, located just 45 miles north of the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa, housed 900 inmates, more than double its 400-person capacity. Officials have reported that one woman on an overnight visit and the chief of the local fire department were among the dead. The remaining deaths were prisoners that died of third-degree burns and asphyxiation while trapped in their cells. Honduras, currently ranked by the United Nations as the most violent country in the world, has a history of fires with mass casualties. In 2005, a fire killed 104 in a San Pedro Sula prison. In 2003, 68 prisoners were burned to death in a prison fire in the coastal city of La Ceiba. Tim Russo, FSRN, La Ceiba, Honduras.
Pre-election demonstrations continue today in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, where opposition protesters clashed with police. Protests have been regular since the Constitutional Court cleared President Abdoulaye Wade to run for a third term. The coalition of opposition groups includes several candidates opposing Wade in the February 26 elections. Youssou N'Dour, a Grammy Award-winning musician from Senegal, has been a regular at the protests.
I think, you know, what's happened today is, you know, most of the people are here just to say no to this constitution, to say no to this president, and to say no for the violence.
N'Dour's bid for the presidency was recently denied by the Constitutional Court. He was seen today by an AP reporter in a confrontation with police. Protesters say Wade's candidacy is unconstitutional. They also argue their right to rally is constitutionally protected, despite the government's claim that the protests was not authorized. Worldwide, malnutrition contributes to the death of 2.6 million children each year. FSRN's Shuria Niazi reports from India, where a new study finds nearly half the children have had their physical and mental development stunted by hunger.
The latest survey from Save the Children finds that 48% of all children in India are malnourished. The report says a large section of the population seems unaffected by the economic progress of the country. Although prices of food grains have dipped recently, those of vegetables, milk, egg, and meat have risen substantially. According to the study, 1.72 million children under 5 years die each year in India. Save the Children conducted the survey in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Peru. The group is trying to persuade international leaders to take up the issue at the May G8 summit in Chicago. It also says empowering small-scale and female farmers could make a significant difference in the lives of malnourished children. Shuria Niazi, FSRN, India.
Los Angeles school district officials have delayed a vote on a massive budget cut that threatens thousands of teachers, librarians, nurses, and counselor jobs, the district's adult education program, arts programs, as well as early education programs. The district is facing a $550 million deficit. The proposed cuts have been met with widespread protests. The LA Times reports, despite the delay, the board did authorize the district to issue layoff notices as it waits to hear from the state about revenue forecasts. 11 Latinos have settled a landmark lawsuit against the U.S. government for immigration and custom enforcement raids conducted in New Haven, Connecticut 5 years ago. Melinda Tuhus has the story.
In June 2007, federal agents arrested 29 people in an immigration sweep in New Haven. 11 of the men filed suit, saying the agents acted in retaliation and entered their homes without warrants or cause. Washington Colala Peñareta is one of the plaintiffs.
No respetaron nuestros derechos.
They didn't respect our rights.
No respetaron nuestra privacidad.
They didn't respect our privacy.
No respetaron las lágrimas de los niños.
They didn't respect the tears of our children.
Fuimos arrestados y conducidos a la cárcel de Hartford.
We were arrested and taken to a jail in Hartford.
As part of the settlement, the men will split $350,000 and deportation proceedings against them have been canceled. Trudy Rebert was part of the defense team from the Yale Worker and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic.
The agreement is among the largest monetary settlements ever paid by the United States over ICE home raids, and the first to include both compensation and immigration relief.
Advocates hope this settlement will help pave the way for a resolution in the cases of several others involved in the 2007 sweeps. Just two of the 29 have been deported. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Senate took up a bill Wednesday that would fund the nation's highways, public transit, and pedestrian and bike programs for the next 2 years. But the senators also debated an amendment to the bill that had nothing to do with roads or trains. The provision, introduced by Missouri Republican Roy Blunt, would give any business owner the right to deny employees medical coverage that clashes with his or her religious or moral beliefs. The amendment continues the debate over reproductive health care, and it's not the only effort to roll back these rights. There are similar bills in the House and Senate, and women's health advocates warn the attacks could continue. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details from Capitol Hill.
The House transportation bill has drawn so much criticism that it's been split into three bills to give it a better chance of passing. The Senate's version, which came to the floor today, has more support. But the bill's co-sponsor, California Democrat Barbara Boxer, blasted Republicans for tacking on an amendment to overturn part of the president's Affordable Care Act.
There's absolutely no connection between the Blunt Amendment and the highway bill. So because this amendment is dangerous and because it has no place on a bipartisan jobs bill, I call on all my colleagues, Democrats, Republicans, and independents to reject it.
Missouri Republican Roy Blunt's amendment would exempt all employers from providing any kind of health care that doesn't click with their religious or moral beliefs, even the owners of secular businesses.
The limits on what they could object to and how they could object to it are so broad, they could essentially claim a conscientious objection for almost anything.
That's Sarah Hutchinson with Catholics for Choice. She outlined some of the scenarios that could take place if the measure became law.
An employer could decide that a single woman doesn't need or doesn't deserve contraceptive coverage because she shouldn't be having sex in the first place. Or an HIV positive person shouldn't be getting treatment because of how they contracted the disease. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Conservative lawmakers in both chambers are pushing similar measures. House Republicans introduced a companion bill to the Blunt Amendment called the Respect for the Rights of Conscience Act. Louisiana Republican David Vitter told reporters Wednesday why he supports the measure.
This is a core, important religious liberty issue.
But some Catholics, including Hutchinson, say the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and their allies in Congress are promoting a skewed idea of the meaning of religious liberty.
They're trying to legislate and put into law that which they believe is what everyone else should do. And that's not what religious freedom is. Religious freedom is allowing each individual to make their choices on how they practice and from intrusion in to how they practice from both government and, frankly, the freedom from religion and having religion be legislated into law.
Meanwhile, in the Senate, Florida Republican Marco Rubio recently introduced the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The bill would allow any employer to refuse to provide health insurance that covers contraception or even contraception counseling. When asked earlier this week about the House and Senate bills, White House Press Secretary Jake Carney called them dangerous and wrong.
It is absolutely vital that women, no matter where they work, have access to the same health care coverage. The preventive services here are important for women's health, and it is important that women, no matter where they work, have access to them.
The backers of the bills in the House and Senate call them conscience clauses. But Eleanor Smeal with the Feminist Majority Foundation says that term is misleading.
What about the conscience of the woman or the man who needs those health care services? What about the conscience of the doctors who know that they can't give the best care because of some government regulation that is taken away from doctors and health care providers and people, disproportionately women, the decision to make to control their own lives?
Smeal added that the Republicans supporting these bills will regret doing so come election time.
I believe that this will galvanize a massive woman's vote. I think President Obama is standing up for the rights of women and, for the, most importantly, for the health of women. And his opponents have been standing with very male-dominated religious interests, not with the people.
According to a CBS New York Times poll, both 61% of Americans and 61% of self-identified Catholics support the idea that employees of religiously affiliated institutions deserve access to free contraceptive care. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Under a deal announced by federal and state officials last week, the nation's five largest banks have agreed to settle a lawsuit over their foreclosure practices. The deal covers Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. The banks will pay more than $25 billion over the next 3 years to help homeowners who lost their homes due to fraudulent bank actions. Wisconsin will get $140 million of the settlement money, but as FSRN's Molly Stentz reports from Madison, it won't all go to struggling homeowners as intended.
The money is supposed to help reimburse Wisconsinites who lost their homes due to bank abuses and to help those on the verge of eviction renegotiate their mortgages. But Governor Scott Walker and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen have decided to take $26 million from the settlement and use it to plug a newly discovered hole in the state budget instead. Here's Van Hollen explaining why he and the governor want to divert a portion of the settlement money away from direct homeowner assistance.
The foreclosure crisis, of course, has impacted all of us. It's impacted the state economy, the national economy. It's impacted all of our values of our homes. It has impacted the jobs in our society. It has impacted law enforcement in our community because blighted homes create a danger for many in our community. We have a portion of the proceeds that are actually coming to each given state to be used as that state deems appropriate.
This move prompted a swift backlash, outraging not only housing rights advocates, but members of Congress, newspaper editorial boards across the state, and even the Wisconsin Property Taxpayers, a group that lobbies against higher taxes. They called the governor's move a hijack. It doesn't sound like a lot of money, said the taxpayers' legislative director, Michael Berkeley.
But it is a lot of money to our members who are underwater in terms of their mortgage payments, and definitely we believe that we ought to help bail them out. That's what this whole lawsuit was about.
Dane County, home to the state capitol, has a foreclosure prevention task force, a coalition of public agencies and nonprofits who try to help homeowners keep their homes. Co-chair Ellen Bernards says she knows exactly what to do with the settlement money.
It would get some frontline people back. Part of the unemployment problem is we've actually lost people in our industry as well. Some of the counties have lost all of their housing counselors due to different budget cuts.
Bernard says there are people and organizations in the state ready to provide more services to struggling homeowners, but they need funding.
Some of the things that could have been done with this money would be programs to deal with neighborhood stabilization, particularly in Milwaukee County, where they have been hit very hard by foreclosures. There's a mediation program in Dane County, as well as many other counties that require funding. And legal services. It would be lovely to have some more money for legal services to help people through what is, in fact, a legal process. And that money needs to come from somewhere.
Milwaukee is considered the ground zero of foreclosures in the state, and Mayor Tom Barrett was quick to criticize the governor's actions. He told Milwaukee TV station WISN on Monday that residents there need the settlement money.
This is a bait and switch. These funds are clearly intended for people who lost their homes, for neighborhoods that have been devastated by the foreclosure crisis. And instead, the governor and the attorney general are saying, well, let's just take this money for something wholly unrelated to this crisis.
Barrett has been suggested as a candidate to challenge the governor in the anticipated recall election later this year, though he has not yet joined the race. The state budget is a particularly hot topic in Wisconsin, since Governor Walker has become famous for attempting to balance it using extreme measures not seen in recent Wisconsin history, such as eliminating public employee unions. Tuesday, February 14th, marked the one-year anniversary of the popular uprising against his actions. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
In Chicago, students, teachers, and parents are drawing attention to a discipline policy in some of the city's charter-run schools that has fined students and their families, sums adding up to hundreds of thousands of dollars. According to data obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request, Noble Street Charter Schools gathered nearly $390,000 over the past 3 years as part of a program that requires students to partially pay for behavior classes and detention. Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel has praised Noble as an example of school reform, and the city is pushing to expand the company's control of schools in the city. For more, we're joined by Joel Rodriguez with Voice, a group that advocates for education justice led by students of color. He's based at Gage Park High School in the south side of Chicago. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, explain how this system works. Under what circumstances would a student get fined, and how is the money collected?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is that students have been fined for really minor infractions. And so, for instance, if a student gets 12 detentions, they are fined. And what we're seeing that students are getting detentions for chewing gum, not wearing the proper uniform, very insignificant, very minor infractions to their student code of conduct. And it's definitely not just unfair. These are families that are underserved. With the current situation, the financial situation that many of our families find themselves, is something that we have to really take a close look at. $200,000 off the backs of families. I know that this is unjust. There's definitely other measures that these schools can put in place to deal with some of the issues that they're saying they're having in these schools.
As you mentioned, the company collected $200,000 in over the 2010-2011 year. That's a figure that is confirmed by the company Noble Network. In a statement released this week, the CEO or superintendent defended the policy, Michael Milkey. He said, quote, "The discipline code teaches many lessons to students, including self-discipline, punctuality, organization, respect, and responsibility." Your response to that rationale?
Yeah, so if the main priority is to educate our young people, our students, if you look at the data in CPS, because of all the disciplinary infractions that were recorded, students lost over 300,000 days of school. So I want to question, what are our priorities? There's other methods of dealing with students misbehaving. There's restorative justice that we are pushing, and we are behind. I know that's being thrown around, but in the school that we are working in, for instance, we have implemented restorative justice in a great way, and we've seen a dramatic decline, and we've invested a lot of energy and time into the freshman class, and piloted some of the restorative justice programs, and we've seen a 50% decline in out-of-school suspensions, because we're looking at unique ways where we're not going to kick kids out. They're not going to be at home sitting 5-10 days at home on the streets, which can create a whole whole world of other problems.
Is that model of restorative justice taking place now at the Gage Park High School that you work at?
Yes, Yes. We're implementing it. We have implemented in the freshman class with the goal of implementing it for the whole school.
This issue of fines is part of a larger policy of discipline in the city schools. Your organization, Voice, pointed out in a 2011 study that there were some 4,600 school-based arrests of students that are 16 years and younger in 2009. What effect does this have on students?
If you send a kid home for a week for fighting, let's say 5 days for fighting, what is that really solving? Statistics are proving that is not—it's not as effective. In fact, it's having a really profound impact in the future of these young people. They get arrested. They're going to get off track. Now they got a record, and it's very likely that they're going to end up back in the system, in the correctional system. So it's very important that we understand the magnitude of arresting kids, and the school to prison pipeline is something that we have to pay much more attention to.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has pushed to expand Noble in city schools, and this week he defended the discipline policy. He praised the schools for what he called the high graduation rates. Have you been in touch with the mayor's office or with Noble, and have they responded to your criticisms?
Yes, we've reached out to CPS officials. We definitely want to sit down. We believe that this has to be addressed. And I think that just by saying a school that, you know, that these numbers showing them that they have a high graduation rate, I think we have to really take a close look at that. I would like to find out in those schools how many kids are being pushed out. That they're looking so good. We've reached out to several of the CPS officials, and we hope to have continued conversation around this issue.
Joel Rodriguez works with Student Voice and the Southwest Organizing Project at Gage Park High School in the south side of Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hi, this is FSRN Development Director Alan Searle. Today is Support Your Media Day. Join this special one-day online event at fsrn.org right now. Free Speech Radio News is independent. We're your media. Find out more at fsrn.org.
An attempt to privatize some prisons in Florida has been defeated for now. A bill under consideration by the Senate would have reduced state spending on prisons by turning over more than two dozen South Florida facilities to private companies. After a lively debate on Tuesday, nine Republicans jumped ship to join the minority Democrats to shoot down the bill. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, Sean Canan reports.
Opponents warn that privatization of state prisons leads to a loss of accountability and could increase costs to the state. But supporters, including Republican Senator J.D. Alexander, say private prisons would reduce costs and provide better service to inmates.
Providing for an alternative management structure will help give us an opportunity to do a better job of making more of these folks better citizens.
But state-employed corrections officers, labor unions, and their supporters have fought back against the move to privatize prisons. If privatization happened, the officers would lose their jobs and benefits. They would be eligible to apply for similar positions with the private companies, but it's likely their pay or benefits would be less. Speaking on the floor of the state Senate, Republican Senator Steve Ulrich broke rank with party leaders. He argued private prisons wouldn't be as accountable as state-run facilities.
You know, they give us a very heavy responsibility by taking away people's freedom. And I'm scared about the whole idea of private companies being responsible for taking away someone's freedom and keeping them there. And the whole idea of accountability, not through government, but through a private enterprise that's responsible for them, with the primary notion that we expect them to spend less dollars.
Another opponent, Republican Senator Mike Fasano, warned that the promised cost savings may never materialize. He cited an example of how a West Central Florida county had to take over a prison from a private company.
Now you're talking Hernando County with a very small budget is now having to spend $3 million to reverse the major repairs that the private company did to a facility paid for by the taxpayers of Hernando County. In fact, in hiring the county-run prison, it became clear that the quality of officers that the private company had hired was questionable.
Several weeks ago, after Fasano voiced his opposition to prison privatization, the Senate president stripped him of his Budget Committee chairmanship. That committee oversees spending on prisons and the courts. Fasano was also removed from the Senate's main Budget Committee. Because 9 Republicans joined Democrats in opposing prison privatization, the bill was defeated Tuesday afternoon, 21-19. Sean Canaan, FSRN, Tampa.
In Cambodia, Buddhist monks are leading a program to counter discrimination against people with HIV/AIDS. An estimated 60,000 have the disease, including more than 30,000 women. Although infection rates have dropped over the last decade, those with HIV/AIDS still experience stigma. Program coordinators say so far it's been successful in reducing stigma and could become a model for other areas. UN Radio's Julie Walker reports.
Monks chant at a Buddhist pagoda in the heart of rural Cambodia. They're using their spiritual practices to help families deal with the consequences of living with HIV and AIDS. Sheng Sophia tested positive for the virus in 2002. A year later, her husband died of AIDS.
Before I started in the program, I used to think I was the only one suffering, and I would get angry and hit my son. But the program has helped me carry on with my life.
Her 11-year-old son, Sang Pana, agrees the program has helped.
There are still days when she does not feel good, but now she won't hit me anymore.
The Buddhist Leadership Initiative was launched by the Cambodian government in 2004 with UNICEF support. It's now active in more than half the country, where an estimated 75,000 people live with HIV. UNICEF's Ulrich Gilbert says the program has been instrumental in helping to reduce stigma and discrimination.
Even after 10 years into the epidemic, in Cambodia, stigma and discrimination is prevailing. So monks have played a significant role to try to shift that. And I think there's a lot of lessons we can learn in terms of broadening the scope or applying faith-based responses to other development challenges.
The monks also lead HIV education programs for children, which include handing out small amounts of money to help their impoverished families cover basic needs such as health care and school supplies. Sam Sforian of the Cambodian government says the material and the spiritual must go hand in hand.
You cannot just give money without education and advice, and they need to take away something inside with education from us and spiritual guidance from the monks.
The Buddhist Leadership Initiative has also been active in China, Laos, Myanmar, and Vietnam. Julie Walker, United Nations.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. Today is Support Your Media Day. The one-day event brings together grassroots independent media from across the country. Join our partners and show your support. Find out more at fsrn.org. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.